This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. For almost 200 years, the English music world waited for the next great English composer, someone to take up the mantle of Henry Purcell, who died in 1695 and still is considered by many to be the greatest of all English composers. Many were popular in their day, names like James Brooks, Samuel Wesley, William Sterndale Bennett, and others, but their fame was fleeting, and the English watched enviously as Austria produced Haydn and Mozart, Germany produced Beethoven, Brahms, and Wagner, France, Berlioz, and Bizet, Russia, Tchaikovsky, and the Mighty Five. Then suddenly, in rapid succession, Edward Elgar, Ray Vaughan Williams, and Gustav Holst gave the English reason to be proud of their musical tradition again, especially in the world of symphonic music. And out of this new English tradition, young William Walton may have made the biggest splash, thrilling and scandalizing English audiences with his Portsmouth Point Overture and Facade while he was still in his early 20s. William Walton was born in 1902 in the Lancashire town of Oldham. His father was a choirmaster and his mother an amateur singer. Walton entered the choir school of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, at 10 and began to compose when he was just 12. He went up to Oxford at 16, but never finished. By that time, he had been adopted by his school chums, Osbert and Sacheverell Sitwell, who were rapidly becoming prominent writers, as was their sister, Edith. The Sitwells helped keep Walton afloat so that he could continue his studies on his own, and he spent most of the 1920s composing in the Sitwells' attic. Between the four of them, their collaborations produced at least two of the most popular and endearing works of English music of the early 20th century. Facade, Walton's chamber entertainment based on poems by Edith Sitwell, and his tribute to the legacy of Handel, the oratorio Belshazzar's Feast. The idea of writing a symphony, though, made Walton nervous, as it had Brahms and others before him. Writing a symphony meant staking a claim to greatness, and Ray Vaughan Williams had already established himself with four great English symphonies by the time Walton began his first. But Walton already had a reputation as a popular composer in the symphonic style, with his two great concertos for violin and viola, Belshazzar's Feast, and especially the first of what would become a series of wildly popular film scores. In 1931, he felt ready to commit himself to a grand and serious statement. It's one thing to have a head full of ideas, though, and quite another to be able to shape them into a 40-minute symphonic argument. Themes wandered from movement to movement, changing tempo and character along the way, and Walton's progress was slow. Ironically, he was both hindered and, as it turned out, helped by the fact that in the middle of the process, his girlfriend dumped him. Walton had been seeing the Princess Emma von Dernburg for 2 years and was convinced that they would be married, but she eventually left him for a Hungarian doctor, and he poured all of his anger at her into his symphony. The symphony begins with an almost inaudible timpani roll. Then, still softer, four horns enter, one at a time. A ghostly oboe melody unfolds over this in slow motion. This melody ranges far and wide, but stubbornly stays anchored to where it began, the note B flat. ¶¶ Now, in the early 1930s, as far as the English music world was concerned, the work of Jean Sibelius represented the ideal of contemporary symphonic writing. Now, Walton's symphony is far from an imitation of Sibelius, but the influence of the Finnish composer is everywhere in this piece, in his use of pedal tones, grand, solid bass notes that anchor whatever goes on above them and lend a sense of grandeur to the whole enterprise. Eventually, those pedal tones lead the harmonies to G, and then finally to C, culminating in a big brass melody that wouldn't be out of place in a late 20th century movie score. One of the other ways Sibelius influences Walton's symphony was in the way Sibelius's later symphonies were constructed. Compact, concise, following the argument directly without a lot of digressions. Given the circumstances of Walton's symphony's composition, it all suggests the effect of a single enraged climax. The second movement, Scherzo, offers more anger and some of the same kind of sarcastic humor that Shostakovich would use so effectively in his symphonies. The rhythmic patterns of the movement shift between the mercurial and the obsessive. This is a movement in which Walton demands the most in concentration and skill from the players. It is not a score for the faint of heart. Thank you. The slow movement took Walton more time to write than the first two together. When you hear the flute, listen to the melody. It's actually a variation on the tune that opened the first movement. The slow movement is structured as an arch, piling passionate moment upon passionate moment like a snowball rolling downhill as it leads up to, and then away from, a melancholy climax. The finale caused Walton no end of trouble. The conductor, Sir Hamilton Harty, who is one of Walton's great champions, had announced that the symphony would have its premiere in March of 1934 as part of his first season with the London Symphony Orchestra, and other performances were scheduled in anticipation. But Walton was stuck. In addition to being depressed about his breakup with Emma, he had fallen ill and was unable to work. He gave Harty permission to premiere the first three movements, and they were a huge success, which, ironically, made it even harder for Walton to finish the finale. Finally, in April 1935, he phoned his close friend, composer Constant Lambert, who suggested he write a fugue. "But I don't know how to write one," said Walton. Lambert replied, "There are a couple of rather good pages on the subject in Grove's dictionary." So Walton got out his Groves and wrote the fugue. But even this worried him, because Vaughan Williams had also used a fugue in the finale of his Fourth Symphony, which had had its premiere that same month. Still, on August 30th, Walton said the symphony was finished, and it was introduced 2 months later. By this point, He had fallen in love again, and even though he dedicated the symphony to Emma, his old girlfriend, the shift in character of the finale from the first three movements reflects his newfound happiness. Walton's design for the finale was made to please, with majestic music at the beginning and end, and three segments of quicker, more excitable music in between. First, a very cinematic, almost violent section in the style of Belshazzar's Feast. Next comes the fugue that Walton was so worried about. Clearly, his studies paid off. Then another quick, nervous section. Suddenly, the two timpanists enter in an attempt to break up this musical party. The timpani entrance makes way for a poignant trumpet solo that almost sounds like taps, perhaps Walton's requiem for that other relationship. But suddenly, the past is put in the past, and the timpanists return to clear the way for the triumphant finale. When the first three movements had their premieres, it hadn't been made clear that the symphony wasn't finished, so critics were split on whether the finale was an afterthought or the strongest part of the symphony. Eventually, the latter view prevailed, and even those who wouldn't call Walton one of the greatest 20th century composers would agree that this is one of the great 20th century symphonies. Thank you. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.